B. Collins. Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Tuesday, November 26, 2019. We'll have a podcast for you tomorrow and then take the rest of the week off like normal Americans. And we're saying hallelujah because the rainy season has finally started here in California. It puts the risk of wildfires behind us in most cases. There is a fire burning near Santa Barbara, and we are sending this storm front southward to try to extinguish that in short order. Today, I am very pleased to invite you to listen to an in-depth interview podcast. You've got the whole holiday weekend to download and listen to it. And it takes on a real controversial topic. It's about vaccinations. And my guest is Bernice Hausman. She's chair of the Department of Humanities at Penn State University's College of Medicine. And I consider her capital B brilliant. She also has taught English at the college level. She has minored in medicine she's just an interdisciplinary genius, in my humble opinion. And her new book is called Anti-Vax. And I give her credit because coming out of academia and science as she has maintained an open mind about those of us who have some skepticism about vaccinations, about mandatory vaccinations, about legal deals now. We are seeing state laws, including here in California, that really give people no other option except to accept vaccination of their children as they wish to enroll in public schools. So what is brilliant about Bernice Hausman is that she examines the concerns in a very even-handed way of people who have misgivings about vaccination. And in the nearly hour-long interview, we explore a range of topics related to the skeptics and the resistors. She never makes a judgmental comment. And in her book, she makes it clear that she generally supports vaccination, but she has a deep understanding of people who resist. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Professor Hausman, where she talks about the new California law and how people will work around it by homeschooling their kids if they decide to.
So since California's more strict vaccination mandate law was passed, there have been an increase in the number of medical exemptions for vaccines and an increase in the number of children homeschooled, I believe. There was an interesting article published recently in Pediatrics, which is the official journal of the American American Academy of Pediatrics, and arguing that very little of the increase in vaccination rates in California can be connected to the new law, that it really was can be attributed to the tightening up of existing restrictions, making sure that children who had a contingent admission to school were being vaccinated, and some other areas. I think we're going to see what the effect of this idea of tightening vaccine mandates is on both vaccination rates and on public sentiment. And I think, again, it goes back to sort of these questions around democracy, what happens when people believe different things, and what are the right mechanisms to ensure strong public health initiatives in this country. And I'm not sure that forcing people to do things they think is dangerous for themselves and their children, really dangerous, is always the right thing to do.
That's Professor Bernice Hausman, the author of the new book, Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. I highly recommend it, and I hope that you'll listen to the interview podcast. It might give you an extra topic to upset your relatives with at the Thanksgiving dinner table, assuming you either work through impeachment and Trump or avoid it, like many families will probably do this year. So the news from a judge in Washington could not be more explicit. District Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson was given the case of whether Don McGahn, the former White House counsel, must respond to a subpoena from House impeachment investigators. Now, be aware that the McGahn case here originated out of the Mueller investigation, and because of the claims of obstruction of justice, to which McGahn was a central figure, he was subpoenaed by the House Oversight Committee before this Ukraine impeachment thread got going. So Judge Jackson, in a blistering ruling, said presidents are not kings. They do not have subjects bound by loyalty or blood whose destiny they are entitled to control. So she ordered McGahn to appear, and her ruling is broad enough that it could apply to other officials, including John Bolton, who claims that he's special because he dealt with national security and he wants a judge to decide whether a congressional subpoena applies to him. And he's playing coy here because he has been dangling that he's got goods on Trump, that he wants to testify. But then his lawyers operate in a very resisting way. So what remains to be seen here is how quickly the appeals play out. And the Justice Department, that's in quotes, has already filed. I predicted they'd do it by 1 p.m., but they were there, I think, first thing this morning in court filing their appeal. And, of course, it'll go to the D.C. Circuit. And then, ultimately, we can expect that if it's an adverse ruling, that Trump will appeal it to the Supremes. And that could drag out for a long time, as long as next June, for the Supreme Court to issue a ruling. Now, they could do it sooner if they wish to. They intervened pretty early in the cycle related to Trump's tax returns. And so they have that flexibility. It's just very difficult for outsiders to predict how they would proceed and how quickly. So again, it's a broad ruling, but it leaves unanswered the questions that lawmakers will be permitted to ask, and can they compel answers on things where a claim of executive privilege or, more likely national security is invoked. Here's another quote from the judge. She said, in declaring that absolute immunity from congressional subpoenas for senior-level president aides simply does not exist, she spoke scornfully of the memos coming from the Office of Legal Counsel. Quote, absolute testimonial immunity for senior-level White House aides appears to be a fiction that has been fastidiously maintained over time through the sheer force of repetition. And I think she has a very good point there. And just to give you a little presidential whiplash today, Trump is claiming that he wants administration officials to testify in the inquiry, but he's worried about the precedent it would set for future presidents. Now, he doesn't give a damn about precedent and future presidents. This is a feint, and I spell it not with an A, but with an E. He is feigning, he is dodging, he is lying. And we know that he is not going to actively invite his people to cooperate with the Democratic impeachment inquiry. So this gets in a little complicated zone because over at the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff sent a letter to all of his Democratic colleagues saying, we got what we need and the impeachment train is ready to leave the station. He says he has conclusive evidence against Trump. He says the panel will prepare a report summarizing the evidence from its investigation, which will then be handed over to the Judiciary Committee next week after Congress returns from the Thanksgiving recess. Quote from the letter, over the course of our inquiry, we have uncovered a months-long effort in which President Trump again sought foreign interference in our elections for his personal and political benefit at the expense of our national interest. As the evidence conclusively shows, Trump conditioned official acts, a White House meeting desperately desired by the new Ukrainian president and critical U.S. military assistance, on Ukraine announcing sham politically motivated investigations that would help Trump's 2020 reelection campaign. He said the committee will continue to investigate and doesn't foreclose the possibility of further depositions or hearings. But this fast-track impeachment, again, it can be amended in the Judiciary Committee where they can add articles related to contempt of Congress and the obstruction of the congressional investigation. And I hope you're not tired of hearing me say that they've got to include the Mike Cohen crime, the payoffs to Stormy Daniels and the other alleged mistress. It is a clear-cut case that doesn't require any further investigation, and Trump is guilty. We already know that. So we will see how the package is fashioned, but it's pretty clear the Democrats will vote to impeach at the House level, and there will likely be a trial in the Senate sometime next year. Meanwhile, we're learning that Mark Penn, who I find one of the more odious Beltway bandits who has advised Bill Clinton, and he was a top strategist for Hillary Clinton's losing presidential effort in 2008. He is a smug corporate toady. Now we learn that he has become an advisor on impeachment to Donald J. Trump. He spent more than an hour in the Oval Office this past Monday. He brought polling data, impeachment advice for the president, and according to people who were in the meeting, he said that because of his experience with Bill Clinton's impeachment, that Trump should stay on the road and keep governing, if that's what he's doing. But just this connection, it's just so disgusting that a guy like Mark Penn, who has already made tons of money greasing the way for corporate power in this country, would sign on to assist Trump. And how different is he from an Afghan warlord who goes where the power and money centers are, regardless of history, ethics, principles, you know, that kind of stuff. Interesting piece today at the Washington Post where Aaron Blake uses Fiona Hill and her testimony last week to smack Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State. Now, Pompeo is a slippery and slimy, sleazy guy. He is Trump's biggest ally. He certainly has covered for him. He is pretty deeply implicated in the Ukraine Gate scheme. So he was asked, do you believe that the U.S. and Ukraine should investigate the theory that it was Ukraine and not Russia that hacked the DNC emails in 2016? Pompeo, anytime there's information that indicates that any country has messed with American elections, we not only have a right but a duty to make sure we chase that down. And I served as CIA director for the first year and a half of this administration. I can assure you there were many countries actively engaged in trying to undermine American democracy. To protect our elections, America should leave no stone unturned. So whatever nation it is that we have information that so much suggests that there might have been interference, we have an obligation to make sure that the American people get to go to the ballot box. Now, of course, I have mixed feelings about this because Yasha Levine, I reported on this Friday, and you can read his piece about, yes, there was Ukrainian meddling in 2016. It's up at the Gray Zone Project website, in addition to the link I gave you last week to Yasha's own Substack page. But the Ukrainian meddling that Pompeo is supporting an investigation of is this idea that there was a CrowdStrike server in Ukraine that would offer some evidence that it was Ukraine that hacked the Russians and gave that to WikiLeaks. And, you know, that's where, for me, that line of intrigue falls apart. So I want to turn to the 60 Minutes broadcast this past Sunday, and our friend Bill Binney, the former technical director of the National Security Agency, who is a big skeptic of Russiagate, he called my attention to it in an email, and last night I caught up with the 60 Minutes report anchored by Bill Whitaker. And this is just another piece of yellow journalism, because Bill Whitaker trots out an FBI guy whose name is Robert Anderson, and Anderson's commentary is used as the evidence for this entire segment. And number one, Anderson says, oh, yes, Russia did, do the hacking and flipping of the information in 2016. Then we get Assistant Attorney General John Demers. Whitaker, this really happened? Demers, yes, that really happened. And we believe that if we had to, we could prove that in court tomorrow using only admissible non-classified evidence to 12 jurors. And what's he talking about? The phony indictment that Bob Mueller put together in his limited hangout investigation of 12 members of the Russian security agency called the GRU. And while this indictment has a lot of rich detail, an indictment is not evidence. And this is the same ploy that Mueller used in his investigative report. In order to, quote-unquote, prove that Russia hacked the DNC, he cited the intelligence agency assessments from October of 16 and January of 17, which include no evidence. This was a rhetorical loop. So, the detailed indictments refer to the CIA assessments, which offer us no public evidence. And then the indictments are treated as the public evidence because this guy Demers at the DOJ says if we had to, we could prove that in court tomorrow using only admissible non-classified evidence. Well, if that's the case, why can't you share that with the American people? Because there is no evidence. And then 60 Minutes goes even deeper into this rabbit hole, asserting, again with no new evidence and not even a citation, that the GRU, using Guccifer 2.0, interfered in congressional elections in multiple states, and they cite a case of candidate Annette Taddeo in South Florida. And she simply asserts that her campaign website was hacked and that it must have been Russia. All right, they don't offer any proof. They don't bring an FBI guy. Oh, yeah, we looked at the hack. We looked at the server. We called the NSA, and they told us that they had evidence that the Taddeo website was accessed from Russia. None of that. And we don't need evidence because we already know, because we've been brainwashed by American media and Rachel Maddow's nightly telenovela. This is so insidious. And once again, American journalism has lowered its standards to try to promote a narrative that they think will somehow lead to the expulsion of Donald Trump from the White House. And while I would love to see that outcome, I'm sorry, I can't embrace the process that they're attempting to use here. Show me the evidence, and I will believe that Russia hacked the DNC. But the evidence of an insider leak is so much greater, and it's never been explored. Mueller didn't talk to Binney. Mueller didn't talk to Craig Murray. The former British ambassador said, yeah, I picked up a thumb drive and brought it to Julian Assange. They're not interested in the truth. And this hall of mirrors gets played one day by the Democrats and one day by the Republicans. Now, over at the Post, they're showing that Rudy Giuliani is very efficient with his time and his travel expenses. So we know that he went to Madrid last August, and one of the people he met with was this guy Yermak, who is the chief of staff to President Zelensky in Ukraine. Once again, Giuliani tried to shake down the Zelensky government, saying, you know, give us an investigation and we'll play ball with you. You get invited to the White House. And, of course, the military aid was not explicitly in view, but it was the background pressure point. So while he was in Madrid, Rudy took a couple of days of vacation. And then to help pay for his trip, he met with a guy named Alejandro Betancourt Lopez, who is a wealthy Venezuelan. He's an oligarch from Venezuela. And he is facing criminal charges as part of a $1.2 billion money laundering case filed in Florida. He is now a client of Rudy Giuliani. And Giuliani peddled some influence and got Betancourt a meeting over at the Department of Justice, just like he did for Dmitry Firtash. So Giuliani is now being investigated by the office that he used to run, the Southern District of New York, the federal prosecutor. and we can't fully trust. An investigation by Republicans into a Republican like Rudy Giuliani. But we can cross our fingers, I guess, and hope a little bit. He really is the slimy figure. And he does not have standing even to claim the broad immunity that Trump asserts. And so I don't believe that there's anything legal preventing the Democrats from calling Giuliani to the impeachment inquiry. And I have to ask, why haven't they? Why haven't they pressed that point? Every day I stop for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. And look who's on my list here right now. Judy Holloway, John Morgan, Susan Lewis, she's in far North California, and Richard Mott just renewed an annual subscription. I appreciate each and every one of you, and I thank you for listening and for chipping in the money that helps cover my costs here at the podcast. I walk away with about 12 cents an hour, but I love to do it, and it's cheaper than psychotherapy. I do not object to being more well rewarded for the podcast. And if you want to help facilitate that, visit peterbcollins.com. There's a menu button. You click on that. Then you click on Become a Subscriber. You hit the sign-up page, and you can decide what level of support you're comfortable with. You can also communicate with me at my P.O. Box, number 150-660, San Rafael, California, 94915. Well, it's reached the point where the smears of the Labor Party and its leader and candidate for Prime Minister, Jeremy Corbyn, over false claims of anti-Semitism have really reached a sickening level. And so, after attacks from a top rabbi in Britain that were echoed by the Archbishop of Canterbury, the top rabbi, Ephraim Mirvis, said today that Corbyn has allowed a poison sanction from the top to take root in Labour, saying Jews are justifiably anxious about the prospect of that party forming the next government. Then the Archbishop, Justin Welby, said that there is a deep sense of insecurity and fear felt by many British Jews. So Corbyn said, anti-Semitism in any form is vile and wrong. It is an evil within our society. There is no place for it, and under a Labour government, it won't be tolerated in any form whatsoever. Labour is a party of equality and human rights. Now, Labour and Corbyn are both being smeared in a very orchestrated scheme to paint them as dangerous for Jews and anti-Semitic. And the New York Times has aided and abetted. I have this clip from last Friday's Times, where they talk about a top rabbi on Rosh Hashanah saying that Jews should oppose Labour because of anti-Semitism. Britain prepares for its most seismic elections in decades, and few voters face such an anguished choice as the country's 300,000 Jews. With anti-Semitism surging in Europe and the United States, the debate over how to vote in Britain is already rattling rabbinical conventions. This is underhanded meddling in the British election by the State of Israel. And these exaggerated claims of anti-Semitism because of criticism of the policies of the extreme conservative government, the Likud government of Israel, are beneath contempt. But this is how Israel rolls in the modern world. And Netanyahu, indicted, continues to hold on to office. There was a ruling today from his attorney general that under the law, he's not required to resign. Appears to be a loophole there. But the aggressive smears coming from Israel as that right-wing government attempts to drive forward, and Trump rewarded them by saying that we'll no longer call the settlements illegal. Well, Bernie Sanders stepped in it. He suggested that the $3.8 billion a year that the U.S. gives Israel should be conditioned on humanitarian conditions in Gaza, and that some of that should go to the Palestinians. So the Speaker of the Knesset, Yuri Edelstein, says that Bernie should stop talking nonsense. And then they deploy the attack dog, Danny Denon. He is the current ambassador to the United Nations from Israel. Now, Sanders didn't say anything that the U.S. aid should go to Hamas. But that doesn't stop Danny Denon from just lying. This is the kind of devious attack that is very common. He is suggesting, said Denon, to give less military assistance to the U.S. most important ally in the Middle East in order to give it to Hamas, a terrorist organization that celebrated the tragedy of 9/11. So they don't respond to criticism with honest rebuttals, because they can't. So they must attack the messenger, undermine his credibility, and these are Trumpian tactics. And speaking of the shift in policy that Pompeo announced, that we're no longer treating the Israeli settlements as illegal, there's a great piece published at The Progressive last week by my pal Professor Stephen Zunis, professor of politics, University of San Francisco. And he shows that the illegality of the settlements has been clear under Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. But U.S. policy, going back to the Nixon administration, followed by Ford, Carter, Bush 1, Clinton, Bush 2, and Obama, they have all undermined the obvious illegality of these settlements. In 91, Poppy Bush insisted on a settlement freeze, and in response, leading members of Congress attacked Bush from the right by calling on the president to grant the loan guarantees unconditionally. In the Bill Clinton administration, support for Israeli settlements became apparent, increasing aid to Israel by the same amount deducted from the loan guarantee. Then, during the W. Bush administration, despite explicit calls in the Mitchell Plan, the Zinni Plan, and the Roadmap for Peace for Israel to free settlement expansion, both the administration and the Democratic-controlled Congress failed to press Israel to comply. The Obama administration was more critical of the settlements, but was reluctant to explicitly call them illegal until the very final vote at the end of 2016. As the Democratic nominee in 16, Hillary Clinton argued that the Obama administration had pushed too hard. As a senator, she visited a major Israeli settlement in the occupied West Bank, and the 2016 Democratic Party platform refused to condemn or even mention the Israeli occupation and settlements. And we know that that was a struggle between the Sanders delegates and the dominant Clinton delegates in the wrangling before the convention in 2016. Now, there is a real divide in the Likud party led by Netanyahu, as a young buck named Gideon Saar, S-A-A-R, has said he wants to challenge Netanyahu for the Likud party endorsement, and he wants to call a quick primary. He predicts that the Knesset will not be able to form a government on its own, and that they're going to have to do another round of elections. But it's interesting, very much like Trump, Netanyahu has intimidated most of the members of his party, and they are afraid to step up and say that it's time for Bibi to go. We shall see. Want to recommend a piece published a couple of days ago, actually just yesterday, at Mint Press News under the byline of Delilah Bockstein, reporting that there has been a sharp increase, more than 50%, in the number of violations against reporters for Palestinian media. And she opens with the story of, let me get the guy's name here, my printout. His name is Amarne. I don't have his first name right here. But he was wearing a press jacket. He was covering one of the Friday protests along the West Bank barrier. And he took a bullet from an Israeli soldier who was about 300 feet away. And he has what's interesting is the Israelis said that, no, he didn't get shot with a bullet. It was some object like a stone hurled by a Palestinian protester. Only problem is that his left eye has been removed, and there's a bullet in there that doctors are hoping to surgically extract sometime in the near future. But the increase in the violent treatment and the injuries endured by Palestinian reporters, I think, is significant. Also, Israel has formalized its expulsion, deportation, of the local director of Human Rights Watch. Omar Shakir is now living in Jordan after he was booted from Israel. Israel claims he was a supporter of BDS. He denies it. But that's the way the exclusionary policies work in Israel today. The latest report from the UN Climate Change Panel is bleak, as usual. What they found is that over the past 2 years, despite the Paris Accords, global greenhouse gas emissions have actually increased by 1.5% every year over the last decade. So we're not even slowing our consumption and our spewing. It is increasing every year. And we are sentencing the planet to a possible extinction event. Interesting piece at the New York Times today, where they report that Beijing leaders were very confident that they would prevail in these kind of meaningless local elections in Hong Kong. But the huge victory by the pro-democracy forces, they got all but 50 seats in almost a 500-seat, here it is. They captured 389 of 452 seats. Only 58 are held by the pro-Beijing contingent there. A record turnout of 71% of voters. So even though they don't have much power, these local officials, this was an important proxy referendum on democracy. But what's interesting is the New York Times denies the claims. Let me quote here. After the election loss, Chinese officials resorted to a favorite tactic by blaming the West. For months, officials have said the protests are the work of foreign black hands bent on fomenting an uprising in the former British colony. So hold that thought. That's a denial coming from the official American organ, the New York Times. But if you follow my link in the show file for today's podcast over to Consortium News, you'll see this interesting analysis by Mary Beaudoin, which really delves into the background and backstory of the protests in Hong Kong. And she does suggest the long arm of the American National Endowment for Democracy, having pumped millions of dollars into Hong Kong over the past few years. We are seeing that some of the protests are probably organic, and some may be enhanced, shall we say, by outside support. And if you recall, when I asked Pepe Escobar about this in our most recent interview, he said, well, it's both. It is an organic local protest of people who are chafing at Hong Kong's, at Hong Kong's subjugation to Beijing. Here's the figure. Since 2014, the NED has officially poured over $29 million into pro-democracy organizations in Hong Kong. And I don't think that has escaped the attention of the strong-arm leaders in Beijing. Here in the United States, the conservative Democrats and their media gatekeepers keep the pressure on to define Medicare for All as a political liability. And I am so sick and tired of this. Over the weekend, a friend of mine, we've been friends since the 1970s, was visiting and we were talking, and he asked me, he said, you know, I'm a little confused because everybody tells me that Sanders and Warren are too left. They're going to be tagged as socialist and the Democrats will lose. And it's just the other way around. Joe Biden or Pete Buttigieg or pick your conservadem, they will not drive the turnout that Democrats desperately need to prevail in 2020. What will? even if you think that Medicare for All is a false promise. It will excite voters who can't afford Obamacare, and fewer people are committed to their private health insurance plans than is widely purported by the conservadems and their echo chamber in the corporate media. So we're going to hear more of this. They're going to tell us that the Democrats will lose because Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota says so. People have to be strong in their convictions, and Democrats have to be courageous in order to vanquish Trump. It won't happen through milquetoast approaches. Out in Montana, federal authorities are colluding with the local police to prevent or to respond to any fresh protests of the Keystone XL pipeline. And I want to let you know that there are proceedings in Montana federal court, and Stephen Volker, the attorney who's been on our podcast before, who is leading that legal team, has told me he is expecting a favorable ruling in mid-December. So we'll keep you posted on that. But meanwhile, the arms that we were told were going to protect us from foreign terrorists are being deployed against domestic, nonviolent First Amendment protests. A joint terrorism task force involving the U.S. Attorney's Office and other agencies is preparing to assist in the response, and a critical incident response team will be available for domestic terrorism or threats to critical infrastructure. And we saw the way they rolled up Standing Rock with paid FBI informants, seducing some of the protesters. Our government, that was under Obama, don't forget that. Our government will find no bottom when it comes to suppressing free speech in facilitating corporate crimes like the Keystone XL pipeline. Today, there are 200 protesters outside a Google office in San Francisco, and they are protesting the retaliation and, in some cases, termination of people who protested last year. One of them, Rebecca Rivers, a software engineer who had been involved with internal protests against Google's work with ICE and CBP, she announced that she was fired on Monday. Three other Googlers were fired on Monday, and this shows that the do no evil or don't be evil culture is fading under a kind of more authoritarian structure at the Googleplex in Silicon Valley. I want to commend the editors of the Bay Area News Group because they raised a point that we talked about here last week, that the Democrats rushed through a short-term funding bill for the government that included extension of domestic surveillance programs. And they point out that the renewal of the phone records aspect of the law is just asinine. Last year, the program designated only 11 targets, but they vacuumed up the call records of over 19 million phone numbers, collected over 430 million call detail records in order to investigate 11 people. And the Democrats just keep extending the Fourth Amendment violations that started under George W. Bush. So Melania Trump put on some swanky clothes. She went to Baltimore today to address a group about opioid awareness. She went to the Be More Youth Summit. And she got booed. She got booed when she walked on stage. She gave some sort of a speech, about 6 minutes long. And she was booed again as she left the stage. I have no further comment. Thanks for joining me for my news and comment podcast. You're free to share it all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube. And I am still Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.